The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Orthodox Nationalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor, a professional writer, and a priest of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. His website is rusjournal.com. That's rusjournal.com. Now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to another edition of The Orthodox Nationalist. And for those of you who are new to the program here, this show is, in essence, a series of lectures on an area that I have spent my entire academic career and adult life studying, and that is the historical, economic, theological, literary, and aesthetic life and tradition of Russia and Ukraine. It's a highly specialized program. It's a highly focused program. But given the huge amount of information that's available on any of the topics that you see on this network, specialization and focus are absolutely necessary. This is what I do for a living as a professor, as a writer, as a speaker. And I also want to make it clear that I'm not part of any particular American or Western social or political movement. I'm fairly independent in that respect. I generally don't follow a line, but I am a loyal son of the Orthodox Church of both its Eastern and Western variants. And I want to remind you that the West, Western Europe, was an Orthodox society doctrinally prior to the schism between East and West, which was actually a process rather than a moment between really the turn of the first millennium and 1100. And it was made absolutely certain and irrevocable when the Crusaders sacked Constantinople in 1204. So that's what we do here. And I think that for a lot of people who want to educate themselves, a lot of people on the so-called right wing of American life, the Slavic world and the Russian world is somewhat of a black spot to them. And there's a lot of myths and stories floating around about these people rejecting that and trying to change people's opinions about that stuff is very, very important to me. And the idea is, and this is common in Russian literature, that Russia has something to teach the West about society, about philosophy and logic and metaphysics that is really foreign to Western modes of thinking. And that's something else that I've done in the past on this show. Now, today what we're going to deal with is something that I've had a bunch of requests to do. And I've actually written on this in the past. This is a huge area for anybody who specializes in old Russia. And that is the nature of the Russian commune. And there's been a lot of people in various aspects of national anarchism and Christian traditionalism and the Orthodox and even the Catholic world who are interested in the Russian commune, why it lasted so long, and its significance in Russian history, how it worked and how it functioned, both as an economic organization as well as a social and political organization. And that's the general topic we're going to deal with today. The concept of the commune is something that I dealt with in my first book, the Third Rome, which I know the Barnes Review has republished, and I appreciate that. And I said a couple of things. I when I dealt with the question of serfdom, I didn't endorse the concept. I said two things. Number one, that serfdom was forced on Russian society by the time of troubles, the Polish and Swedish invasions, the complete disruption of that society, and the fact that the Russian soil and landscape is poor enough that that kind of communal organization is necessary to spread the intense labor fairly over the people who are living on the commune's property. The other thing I said was that the commune made serfdom more tolerable than it would have been otherwise. The commune, as an ancient Russian institution, it's talked about by most of the ancient monarchs of Russia, Ivan the Terrible in particular, who really gave it new powers and a new sense of independence. The commune under serfdom meant that the communal elders were the ones who dealt either with the landlord or the landlord's steward. So Russian serfdom, and it was very difficult, although you can't put that on the Russian Empire or the Tsar or the Church or anybody else, although it is Filaret of Moscow who wrote the Emancipation Decree in 1861, who was the head of the Church in Russia at the time. It's something that was forced on the society, her military situation, her economic situation, the nature of her soil, and the fact that the commune itself was a mediary between landlords and peasants. So any landlord knew that he was dealing with associations of peasants, not peasants individually. When you have wealthier countries, countries with much richer soil like Ukraine, the commune didn't develop. The real problem with Russia's treatment of Ukraine in the 18th and 19th centuries, and really even before that, or at least Eastern Ukraine, or what we call Left Bank Ukraine, was that they gave Ukrainian lands to Russian nobles and Russian settlers, and then imposed serfdom on a group of people who had never known serfdom before. And I'm willing to say that in general, it's the nature of the soil that meant that in poor soil regions in the Slavic areas, the commune developed with substantial powers in places that require less labor per acre, places that have better weather, a longer growing season, and just richer soil, places like Ukraine. The commune really didn't develop. So this is something that it has to do with geography, and it has to do that with, you know, in large parts of Russia, the growing season is only 6 to 8 weeks. And so the labor has to be quick, it has to be intense, it has to be fairly precise. And this is another reason that in the colder areas of Russia, the commune developed with great powers, especially in the area of organizing labor, and then later on in the organization of paying taxes. An individual peasant family did not pay taxes. The commune paid taxes. Okay, I have a ton of information on this topic, and there's really no way we can get through it in an hour. But I want to say, I want to make a few points. The commune was a democratic institution to the point where it was largely communal and anarchistic. It created the habit of self-rule amongst peasants throughout Russia that really didn't exist in most other places. It was a direct democracy between peasant families electing all functionaries and all employees of the commune. There was no intermediaries. It is an ancient institution. The entire community was involved in this, men, women, and children. It normally met after the liturgical services on Sunday, and it had an extensive area of competence. It dealt with all aspects of life, economic, social, political, even religious. The commune decided whether or not the society was to adopt the old belief, the new ritual, whether they were going to have priests or not, because many of the old believer communities did not have priests. And I'm willing to say that it is so old that it existed and functioned prior to there being any written law. And so the commune is the basis of everything Russian prior to the revolution. Even in urban areas, workers created the so-called artel, which is it's a more voluntary commune, but it's a commune that functioned very much like a guild, and people specializing in the same area. So, as far as peasant self-government is concerned, what you have is probably the most democratic society that ever existed. You had two levels of representation. You had the commune as the very lowest level, from a political point of view. And then you had the volost. The volost is a grouping of three or four communes. It's a little bit like a township that developed in Great Britain and in America. But it also had exclusively elected bodies. And the different communes, of course, would elect representatives to go to the volost system. So you had two levels of peasant self-government in Russia. And really the problem is, when you had Englishmen and Americans continuously condemning Russia for its absolute monarchy, even though that's a very problematic issue, a very problematic phrase. No monarchy was ever absolute. That's impossible, administratively impossible. But when an American capitalist or a British capitalist would condemn the Russian monarchy, which they did fairly often, especially at the middle and end of the 19th century, the British were the primary enemy of the Russian state because of their colonial empire in India and in Asia. The British were very threatened by Russian expansion. They talk about the, you know, really meaningless democracy at the national level, which is controlled by the newspapers and the rich and those people who can finance candidates, but did not have this intense local democracy where a peasant worker can actually really matter in the day-to-day functioning of the commune and then the commune's representation in the local volost. For those of you who know something about Russian history, I want to make it clear that the volost and the zemstvo are two different things. The zemstvo would correspond vaguely to our county, where the volost would correspond vaguely to our township. But even the zemstvo was essentially a bicameral system, noble representation and peasant representation. So in reality, you really had three local bodies with substantial peasant self-government. And because they were local, everybody was known to all involved. And in the democratic process, a peasant can actually really matter. We know that as individuals, we matter nothing in terms of national or even state elections. If we had a strong, thriving democracy like you had in Tsarist Russia, we would be far better off as people, and certainly politically and economically better off. The communal system was the basis of my defense of Tsarist Russia in my first book. And some people have read that thing, and they've really very much misconstrued it. What I said was that the Tsarist institutions functioned fairly well and were morally legitimate, not only because they were generally popular, but even more so because they oversaw a empire, at least in Russian forested areas, not so much in Ukraine and elsewhere, but in colder, more inhospitable central Russian areas, heavily forested, often very difficult to farm. They oversaw a highly democratic communal set of governing structures. the existence of these structures and the self-government that was thriving continuously within them proves the fraud of those anarchists and leftists within Russia and elsewhere who talk about the creation of these communal institutions, and yet they already existed. They existed, they functioned, they dealt exclusively with local affairs, and yet you had all of these different movements in Russia and the West talking about building community and building communes, and yet not only did they reject the Russian communal system, they were extremely hostile to the Russian communal system. It strongly suggests that these leftists were not telling the truth when they talked about the commune. What they meant was labor collectives that they and their party controlled. No one could control the Russian commune. The Russian commune was a legal person. It was a corporation in the best sense of the word. It was a legal individual with rights and duties. It was completely autonomous in Russian law. The commune, for the most part, was a strictly economic institution. The Volost and the Zemstva above it had a tendency to be a political institution. And what I want to say here is, for the most part, the commune, let's say by the turn of the century, by 1900, the commune dealt with issues of farming and taxation. It equalized landholding among its members. So a family of six, say, was given enough land to feed six people. But not only given enough land to feed six people, given the property owning of the commune, whatever property was under their control, the commune would give a certain percentage of poor land, a certain percentage of okay land, and a certain percentage of great land to each family. So it was basically revolved around the concept of communal liberty, around the concept of communal equality in it, but it did not look at the individual as anything other than a part of the communal society. So by 1900, when foreigners looked at Russia, they saw the peasant family as the cell, the cellular structure of Russian life, the commune, and then those communes and the other local institutions feeding into the state. The state, the empire, was considered one large commune with the Tsar as its elder, its head. In many ways, the Tsar was a prolongation of the father's authority and the authority of the communal head, the communal chairman. It was patriarchal, again, in the best sense of the word. And the empire was viewed as, for better or for worse, as one large family with the Tsar as a little father, which was, you know, one of the ways that he was referred to. The commune and the autocracy were two particularly national institutions in that country. It was the intermediate tiers, the police, the nobility, the noble assemblies, the political movements. These were the problem. This is where corruption developed. And we need to make a very fine distinction when dealing not only with Russian history, but with most royal societies, that there is a big distinction between the monarch and his personal offices and the bureaucracy, the army, the police, the taxation service, local nobility. There's a big distinction between these two things. And by the time 1900 hits, it's not crazy to say, and this is a common peasant belief, that the bureaucracy did X even though the Tsar wanted Y. That's not a crazy thing to say. The bureaucracy worked as a functional commune in and of itself. And being that, you know, it was in St. Petersburg, it was completely alien to Russian society. It was urban, it was cosmopolitan. It was not like the very national, very orthodox communes of the Russian peasant. And the attacks and the mockery of the St. Petersburg bureaucracy is something that was heart and soul of the conservative Slavophiles, the writings of Dostoevsky, Turgenev, Chekhov, of Gogol. In fact, there almost was no major Russian figure that didn't make some reference to the fact that the bureaucracy in distant St. Petersburg, which is essentially a part of Scandinavia, and how alien that was to the average Russian person. The bureaucrats in St. Petersburg knew nothing about the Russian people, never mind the Ukrainian people or the Polish people or the Finnish people, also a loosely part of the Russian Empire. But they were radically alien from everything that was normal, that was Russian, that was traditional in society. This is not necessarily the desire of the Tsar at the time. So we got to be very careful to make it clear that the bureaucracy, the army, tax service, customs, local administration, local noble administration, I should say, at the state level, the governorship level, that these were intermediaries that were not desired either by the Tsar or by the commune, and yet they had to exist for the sake of administration. And this was the biggest problem in Russian political life by the turn of the century. As I said before, by the time 1900 comes around, all aspects of the Russian commune are elected. But by about 1900, they start to be salaried. They become professional bureaucrats within the communal structure. Both the commune and the Volost deal not only with criminal justice, but also with public works. Now, generally speaking, public works, you know, bridges and churches and schools, were usually attached either to the Zemstvo. I think all Zemstvo had schools. Zemstvo had schools, and all Volost societies had schools as well. So at the end of the reign before the war anyway, Russian primary education had gone through the roof. And in dealing with criminal justice, arrest and punishment, generally speaking, peasant people were tried either at the communal level or at the Volost level. It was only really the aristocracy and the townsmen that were given a sort of a normal trial with a regular federal judge. And of course, the court system had been radically shaken up and reformed in the reign of Alexander II. And what happened by the time World War I breaks out, the Russian Empire had a fairly balanced check and balance system at the local level. Because you had the Zemstvo structure that for the most part was run by liberal nobles with some peasant elected input. Then you had the Volost, which really was a peasant institution, although there was some lesser noble presence there. And then you had the communal organization that was strictly peasant and run according to peasant customs. And all of these groups checked and balanced one another, because if the commune did something that was unfair, it wasn't uncommon for peasants to go to the local noble assembly and saying, we need our social betters to come and fix this. So that wasn't uncommon. It was something actually that became very much part of noble society and peasant society at the end of the empire. Now think of it this way. At the local level, the Volost system did whatever the commune was too small to be able to do effectively. And the same thing with the Zemstvo did whatever the Volost did not have the resources to do. So with all the problems you had politically, the local level was fully democratic, was based on checks and balances, had what amounted to a Senate dominated by nobles, and a House of Representatives dominated by peasant institutions, and they checked one another. The biggest problem that these local institutions had is that peasants had the point of view, and it's not a crazy point of view. It may have been exaggerated, but it wasn't a crazy point of view, that the Tsar wanted things for the peasants that the nobles and the police and these other intermediary institutions didn't want. The biggest problem with the emancipation of serfs from, or of peasants from serfdom, was that they received less land than they had before, but they had to pay off the government in installments for this land. The nobles were given what amounted to government grants to give this land away. That paper was guaranteed by the peasants, who then needed to pay it off. Now, Nicholas II canceled those payments. The peasants went too far in arrears, and even worse, the nobles were very badly in debt, which is very typical of noble society throughout Europe. But the biggest problem is that when the serfs were released, they were under the impression that the Tsar wanted them to have all the land, to organize their own life within the communes, and really to destroy the power of not just the nobles, but the foreigners, and the capitalists, and the Jews, and everybody else that they didn't like. So within a year or two after the emancipation in 1861, peasant violence went absolutely through the roof. Nobles were killed by the hundreds. You had uprisings in every major province based on the fact that peasants thought that the monarchy wanted them to take this land and destroy those entities that stood between the peasants on the one hand and the Tsar on the other. Really, the emancipation, this cannot be placed at the feet of the Tsar at all from a moral point of view. But the emancipation was a disaster. Number one, nobles who, at least in theory, where the mainstay of the monarchy were impoverished. The impoverished noble becomes a cultural stereotype in Russia by 1900. By 1900, the nobility had very little power, to be honest. And they had very little money, and whatever they owned, generally speaking, had liens against it all over the place because of their debt. In addition, peasants now automatically had debt because they had to pay the government for the loans, what is essentially a loan or a grant that the government had forwarded to the nobles to release this land to peasant control. It didn't work at any level. The commune was empowered more than ever, and it was fairly popular amongst the peasants. Peasants believed that the people who till the land should own the land, and that those who till the land should be getting together on a regular basis and organizing the duties, the taxes, the work at any point in the harvest season or any point during the agricultural season from spring to fall fairly and intelligently. And then these peasants could then supplement their income in late fall and winter doing cottage industries, handicrafts, and sometimes they would travel to the cities to do some work in the factories and other institutions in urban areas. And there they would simply take the commune to the urban area and form the artel, where you would have the same communal presence in the city that you did in the countryside. Okay, that's the basic introduction to what the commune did. We're going to take a break, and then we will be right back.
Don't go away, because there's more to come on the Orthodox Nationalist. You're listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Visit us at reasonradionetwork.com. Let's return to the Orthodox Nationalist, brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, reasonradionetwork.com.
Okay, welcome back to the Orthodox Nationalist. We're talking about something that I've received a lot of requests on, and that's the nature and function of the Russian Commune in this era, 19th century, very beginning of the 20th century, that we have the most detailed records, how they functioned, how they appeared to foreigners who were traveling throughout the country, how they worked, what was the basic procedure, how did they relate to other levels of government, etc. The commune is something particularly native to Russia. It's something, I mean, native to Russia in the sense that nowhere else did the commune have this level of power. It was a democratic institution, but it also was a totalitarian institution. There was no aspect of life that was considered private, but that's also very typical of the Russian mentality at the time. If you were concerned about privacy, it probably meant that you had something to hide. The commune kept an eye on its members. It expelled members who just would not work, could not pay their debts, were drunk all the time. These people were removed from the commune. The commune, by the way, had the power to send people off to Siberia, which, by the way, was not much of a punishment. The Siberian, there's no such thing as really a prison in Siberia except for the worst of criminals. For the most part, people sent to Siberia were housed in towns and really did travel freely, could travel freely, could work. Often their identity was not known to the local people. So going off to Siberia really was more of a fresh start than anything else. But the commune didn't have this kind of power. The commune collected the taxes. It was given essentially a bill from the government. It then took that bill and organized in the fairest way possible how much each individual family had to pay relative to the bill. And it should be noted that not only taxes, but then also just the debt, the so-called redemption payments that peasants had to pay, that the commune had to pay to the government as surety for the loans that were extended to the nobles at the time of the emancipation. All of this led not only to substantial noble debt, it also led to substantial communal debt. Right? A peasant did not have debt. A peasant did not have assets. The commune had debt, and the commune had assets. There was not a whole lot you could do, even at the federal level, to the communal authority. It was free. It was autonomous. They paid what they could. Tax arrears were common. Debt was common. But in a royal society, as opposed to a democratic capitalist society, those arrears were often canceled. Tax arrears were often canceled. Tsar Nicholas II, with the stroke of his pen, canceled all of these redemption payments to the government, 1905, 1906. Democratic capitalist countries do not. You have debt, you have to pay it off. Remember, they had debtors' prisons in the 19th century in Western Europe. None of this existed, of course, in Russia. So because you had this power, the communal authorities could remove members that were no good to it. And in many cases, some bad members were just simply shipped off to the army. Which, by the way, is the reason that the Russian army has a reputation of being so brutal to its new recruits. That's true. I've heard that from people who've experienced it. But the reason for it is that traditionally in Tsarist Russia, criminals, drunks, habitual debtors, these kind of people were removed from the commune. They could be sent to Siberia, but more often than not, these were the people who were sent into the army when the recruiting sergeant came around. That meant that at any draft levy, the Tsarist army was made up of peasants. Not exclusively, of course, but a good chunk of them were peasants who had been kicked out of their communes. That also meant that the drill sergeants and these people involved in training the Russian army, realized that you had, in some cases, actual criminals here, and we have to treat them very harshly to make sure that they will obey orders. So that's the origin, the historical origin of why the Russian army has this reputation of such brutality within its ranks. So what developed within the communal structure is a village aristocracy. The people who were regularly elected as elders, those connected to them, those who worked for them as official salaried employees of the commune, and the people who really had a vote. Well, let me put it this way: the votes were given not to male heads of household. That's ordinarily how it's stated in the textbook. What it really is that households, as such, were given a vote. And you even had household assemblies, obviously very small household assemblies, who would decide these kind of issues, and then the male head, or in the case of widowhood, female head, would come to the assembly, and they were the ones who would vote. So those who came to the communal assembly are those who were empowered by the family to vote a certain way on a certain issue. There were no rules of order. There were no rules of procedure. And like a lot of these things, sometimes fights would break out. But that was the nature of peasant self-government. So it's kind of ridiculous by 1900 to say that Russia was not a democracy. Russia had a democracy where it counted. It had a democracy at the local level where the average person could actually have a vote. But something else should be said in terms of procedure. Unlike the Volost, the township had a system where essential absolute majorities would rule. That had to be the case because it was larger than the commune. But at the communal level, it was the unanimous consent. You know, I'm choosing my words carefully. Consent doesn't necessarily mean that we agree, but we consent to what the overwhelming majority holds. Unanimous consent was at the basis. To have a basic unanimous consensus, something would then pass. But, you know, even if just a bare majority would accept a certain proposal or a certain division of land, there would be other means whereby people could be convinced to go along. It could be additional compensation. It could be violence. They could be bribed with alcohol. There's a million different ways that this could be done. But nothing, generally speaking, would go forth without basic unanimous consent. But like any organization, there were substantial problems with the communal system. The government liked the commune because it was much easier, and actually saved money and effort, to go to the commune for taxation issues rather than to an individual peasant family. The government liked the commune, even though under the reign of Vita, under Nicholas II, Vita thought that the commune was a problem. It kept the real entrepreneurs from developing as individuals. Everybody was subject to the communal authority. And so slowly but surely, by the time you get to World War I, the commune was disappearing in terms of, I mean, it existed everywhere in Russia, but its powers were being sapped away because a small but significant minority were given the right by the government to leave. These became individual peasant proprietors. It became a problem because the commune, you know, they had tools in common. They had draft animals in common. Some of the richer ones had machinery in common. It's one of the biggest areas, by the way, of trade, Tsarist Russia and America, even though they fought over sugar. Sugar was a huge area of trade battle between America and Russia prior to the war. But farm machinery was a huge area of trade between America and Russia prior to the war. And then after the war and the communists took over, American capitalists rushed in. Henry Ford, I hate to say it, chief among them, rushed in and invested heavily in the new Soviet economy, because the Soviet economy made it clear, the Soviet leaders made it clear that they needed farm equipment. They needed mechanized farm equipment, and American firms kind of, you know, lost it and invested heavily in the Soviet economy. That's only one area of substantial American, so, you know, this is supposed to be the anti-communist power, and yet all throughout Soviet history, the U.S. and the British, these very wealthy capitalists were heavily invested in the Soviet economy, especially early on. The 20s and 30s saw substantial investments by American capitalists, especially in the areas of mechanization, farm machinery, factory machinery, these areas that the Russians wanted, I should say the Soviets wanted, but did not have in sufficient quantities at home. So these peasant proprietors, you know, they were permitted to have private property. It was only a minority who wanted to take advantage of this, a particularly entrepreneurial minority. But they then had to buy their own equipment. They had to buy their own fertilizer. They had to buy their own everything. The thing about the commune is you had everything in common. All the animals, all the machines, all the tools, the land, and even the debt we all had in common. Legal problems we all had in common, and we can figure out what to do at the communal level rather than to have to suffer as more or less powerless individuals that, that developed in Western Europe. But this is what you have to understand. You know, democracy in Western Europe meant the domination of oligarchy. The individual pretty much powerless, although given one vote out of millions, which of course is meaningless. So the individual was powerless in Western societies, but because so much was done at the local level in old Russia, the individual, especially the talented and literate individual among the peasants, this person really could matter and still live a very modest lifestyle. Well, that's something to be said for this system. But a problem developed in that the communes weren't very good at bookkeeping. The richer communes were able to actually hire professional, what we would call an accountant, to keep track of tax duties and farming issues and stuff like this, income and market issues. But in general, the smaller, medium-sized communes did not have these kind of institutions. And it's very difficult. And this actually may be as much a benefit as a problem. It's really hard to collect debt from somebody that doesn't have anything on the books, or doesn't have books. It was very difficult to deal with a commune of 150, 200 people. It's probably the average commune size in Russia. Some were larger, some were very tiny. It's a lot difficult to deal with a large class of people rather than with an individual. An individual you could scare into submission. I think a lot of the court proceedings, credit card summonses and stuff like that, in modern societies, courts and credit card firms and banks, they could scare the individual. The individual doesn't want to go broke, paying a lawyer. And so the mere threat of a lawsuit gets people to pay or, to submit. It's very hard to do in old Russia because, you were dealing, at least at the peasant level, you were dealing not with individuals, you were dealing with communes. Communes were a fairly well-off, powerful, corporate individual. So don't talk about a peasant dealing with a noble. Most nobles were poor, and most nobles were in debt. They weren't a very powerful class either. So when I say noble, don't think of some guy sitting on a throne. That's not how it was, except for a tiny minority of nobles in Russia. You have to think of sort of a noble that we might consider middle class, maybe even lower middle class, with a lot of debt, going up against a commune. Commune, in terms of assets, was about an equal, and in some cases superior, to the noble that it may be confronting. So don't think in terms of individuals. Think in terms of societies. A noble society or a noble family may come in confrontation with a volost or with a commune. That's a more or less equal battle. But when an individual American goes up against a bank, that is not an equal battle. And that this is the kind of society that the royal house oversaw. And it's to their credit. Regardless of all of their errors in dealing with the bureaucracy, in dealing with Poland and Ukraine and dealing with the old believers, the Russian monarchy made a lot of errors and made enemies where they could have made friends. Their great accomplishment was that they oversaw and empowered a highly representative, democratic, really direct democratic, legal, political, and social structure at the local level. The level where it counts, and even more, a level that the average peasant and even the average noble considered their area of expertise. The Russian government never came to the commune and taught them how to farm, taught them how to live. It never happened that way. The average peasant viewed issues like, you know, federal taxation and the draft and foreign policy, that's out of our area of expertise. That's the business of the monarch. The only problem with that was they were afraid that the bureaucrats and the nobles in distant St. Petersburg didn't care about them. And by the way, it's probably true. So many things that a lot of dishonest American historians will say about the Russian monarchy or monarchy in general throughout Europe, really, it should be put at the feet of bureaucrats, policemen, churchmen, these kind of people who made decisions, and sometimes made decisions in the name of the Tsar. So we got to be careful here. I have the feeling that the peasants were right in this particular area, and that they thought that if the Tsar were truly free, which, by the way, he was not, if the Tsar was truly free, politics would be very, very different for us. Economics would be very, very different from us. This is something that was ingrained in the peasant mentality, but I think there's some truth to it. St. Petersburg was a foreign realm. A lot of the people there did not even speak Russian. It was a bureaucratic organization, physically and mentally far from the average person. It is that bureaucracy that not only carried out what they thought was the will of the Tsar, but in fact invented the will of the Tsar in many cases. And so the anger wasn't so much at the monarchy for all the problems and taxes and debt and everything else. It was at the nobility and the bureaucracy that the peasants saw as working for themselves, being dominated by self-interest and not giving a damn of what the Tsar had to say about them or to them. They were necessary for the government to function, but in that process, they looked out only for themselves. And that's really pretty much the basic political theory of the average peasant in Russia in 1900. And those peasants, of course, then were chewed up in the absolutely evil and unnecessary World War One. And World War One was an absolute, unnecessary slaughter of millions of people, and Europe in the world was never the same after that. The only people, I mean, no one won that war. The only people that came out on top, was the United States, and the major bankers, who financed both sides of that war. So, anyway, that's the basic, and I'm only really scratching the surface here. The nature of the Russian commune, what it did, how it functioned, and why, even up until the 20th century, it was the dominant democratic institution within the Russian Empire. Okay, I've run out of time. I thank you guys for listening. Oh, by the way, if you've been emailing me, I got a ton of emails recently. I'm in and out. I don't often get a time to get a lot of time to respond to these. I will get to you eventually. Please be patient. But otherwise, please keep contacting me. Keep writing me if you need to. I appreciate it. Even if it's negative, you know, I'll survive. And I appreciate you guys listening. And I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Nationalist returns Thursday evening, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
tuned into Radio Aryan.